everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Comics Fondle Podcast. This episode is for the weekend of April 3rd, 2015, which means Vernon and I got around to doing another one of these maybe just 2 weeks after the last episode.
Two weeks.
Who knows? Anyway, I'm Andrew, and my blog is the comics or comicsfondle.com.
And I'm Vernon. I'm a proprietor of the Comics Gallery, a fine retail comic book store in Wilmette, Illinois, along the Great North Shore.
And this is our monthly and apparently bi-weekly podcast where we talk about comics. And so we have got a somewhat lighter show than usual as far as issues we're going to discuss, just because it's only been a couple weeks, but we do have some good topics to talk about. And we're going to start with one that I posted a link to it to the Comics Gallery Facebook page, which you all should be checking out at facebook.com/thecomicsgallery, X on the comics, not a CS. And it was from Rich Johnson's site, which means Vernon didn't post it because Vernon boycotts Rich.
Well, I go there once a month.
Okay. And it was about how Marvel is recoloring the first Star Wars trade, or, you know, not trade, but the movie adaptation from 77. They're recoloring it for a collection.
Makes sense. I mean, color, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah.
They're getting rid of Maurice Severin's colors.
Well, you got to remember, this is the only 64-color process back in the day.
Okay, hold on. Wait for this. And they're doing a digital coloring complete with the, you know, blurring to fake depth and light sources and, like, you know, lens flares.
Oh, kind of like George Lucas did with the original Star Wars films. We started acting, what do you call that?
I didn't come up with this, but guess what I'm going to do, Verted? Guess what we're going to have, everyone? I started doing little short movie responses to movies at the stop button, my other website, this year. And so we are actually going to release a completely illegal and completely hidden copy of at least the first issue of Star Wars by Marvel, colored and recolored, side by side as a special edition. There you go.
You can compare at home.
You can compare at home. But only if you're a Comics Fondle podcast listener. And somebody's going to have to remind me of this later because I'm sure I'm going to forget. Anyway, so they're recoloring it. And it looks terrible. And I'm just kind of...
Really? Who colored it? Do they have a name on this project at all? Not that you have an HD, obviously, because it's not out in the market yet.
Well, no, they do have it. I think it's coming out fairly soon.
Yeah, one of their $100 hardcovers or some bullshit.
Keep talking, Vernon, while I type.
I got it. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm curious about it, but, you know, not enough to go spend the money on the big hardcover omnibus that I can't.
Well, because, you know, you don't care about Star Wars because Keith Giffen didn't draw it. Anyway.
Hey, you leave me alone about Keith Giffen. I know it's a weakness of mine, like good beer, but leave me alone.
So it is being recolored by A. Crosley.
Who the fuck is that?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, who cares? It's they're doing this weird...
I read a lot of fucking comic books. I never
Now, you read Darth Vader.
Yeah, I read the first issue.
I would imagine if you when you see these images, you will see them trying to fake an art style more similar to that. What's very amusing, I'm just looking at a page right here, is that who penciled it?
I'm not sure that's a fair comparison because Salvador La Roca does like a lot of the work, and
I meant the cover. I'm sorry, I was going to get to that. I was actually going to say that when you look at these panels from a 1977 Marvel book, even a Star Wars book, some of the splash panels are what you see on covers now.
Yeah,
and with about as much detail. So.
Yeah.
A comic from 1977 made for people who were probably making less than minimum wage, and we know because of Sean Howe's book, they were tripping acid and walking New York City.
Yep.
Those guys put more work into a panel than guys do today that are celebrities for a cover.
And make real money that you can live on.
And have health care. Oh, and the other thing is, okay, I'm just going to mention this, and everybody actually go either to Bleeding Cool or the Comics Gallery Facebook so you can actually see this, because they're getting rid of the white border around the comic and going edge to edge with a panel.
Ugh.
Yeah, okay. If you read comics made before, I don't know, what, 6 years ago, there used to be the white border that, you know, sometimes it was the bleed space for printing.
Gutters.
And now they're getting rid of this, and it looks just wrong because the panels were conceived with having the bleed space. Like, they're, one of the examples Rich has got here is word bubbles going into the two white space that Marvel uses on their digital comics.
It's an
absence of anything in that space. It's not white. It's just the absence of anything. Yeah.
Well, I can't see it myself, but the reformatting of the comic strip for digital, both publication and recoloring, you can go both ways. I've seen really good jobs, and I've seen real hideous jobs. So I'll be looking forward to taking a look at this to see what it looks like.
Okay, nobody let me forget. We're going to do a special, you know, public fair use special. This thing someday.
That's
soon.
Great. Yeah.
But now Vernon's going to talk to us about something else that he's really excited about.
How do the customers at home get this? I missed that, or I would just phase out.
How do they get this entirely illegal thing I have no timeline for, because I don't know when Marvel's publishing this original.
Oh, so they submit your names and then you pull them out of a hat?
No, they don't submit their names. We're going to make it available. I'll link to it from the Facebook page. I don't care.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
You think Disney's going to sue us for... No, this is... we have artistic commentary because Vernon is going
to
make digital... Vernon, a comic book retailer.
Ooh, me?
Is going to legitimize... Oh, actually, wait, hold on. There are tumblers that already do this crap. We're going to move on. You're going to be able to get it at the Facebook page. You're going to be able to get it at comicsfondle.com.
And I'll keep reminding Andrew so it happens.
And, yeah. I just got to find out when the Star Wars comic is coming out so I can get my hands on one. Okay, but Vernon's going to talk about another summer event.
Yeah. My state of confusion as a retailer, not just customer, over the Convergence versus Secret Wars. It's like both of the big guys at both companies went out of their way to like do press releases and talk to people explaining like their plans for these things. And you know what? I'm not that less confused than I was before they started talking about them, because I have like no idea like how these books are going to sell. I mean, you know, MODOK, Secret War story. Like, how do I figure out how sales are going to go on that? Do I even bother carrying something like that? You know, here's the pretty picture, though. They put a James Stokoe variant cover on the fucking thing. Ooh. So my customers are asking about it. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to get the variant, and it doesn't sound like it's going to work out, so I might get, like, three, okay? You know, I don't know what to make out of all these things. And there's, like, this week, here's a good example. Convergence begins next Wednesday. So I have a sale on my rack. This is not an advertisement, where if you buy back issues off the DC rack, they're 50% off, because I got to make room for like 11 or 12 new comics that are coming in next week. So DC and Marvel are really screwing with retailers this summer, and I pray to God that they take good care of them and put out quality product so that half of these poor assholes don't go out of business buying based on the hype. You know, because being a cynical fucker myself, I always err on the side of caution, you know, especially as far as DC and Marvel are concerned. So I may not make money, but I at least don't lose money, you know, ordering comics to my ass that I don't need for wall insulation. But it's almost like a setup to fail, you know, especially Marvel. They're throwing so much product at us, we have no idea what to do, you know. So it should be an interesting summer. So be very nice to your local comic book retailer, I would say, and be understanding and help him not go out of business by buying a couple of these things. You know what I mean? Help him break even. There you go. Here, that should be our mantra for summer. Break even in 2015, you know? So,
break even,
I don't know,
after the summer events.
Yeah, because, you know, Secret Wars is going to go on for like 4 fucking months, man. I'm like, you're serious? You're not going to publish a regular line for like 3-4 months now? I mean, DC at least kept it to 2. so I can get Batman back here in fucking June, for Christ's sake. I don't know when I'm going to see, you know, well, Marvel had a lot of problems. I mean, the multiple versions of their titles that they're trimming down now, but they're combating that with like lots and lots of comics. I mean, they may only publish one or two Avengers now, but they're like weird mutant Avenger titles, you know? And I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I'm not scared because most of my customers don't read this pabulum anyway. Some of them are very good, and there are some good Marvel and DC comics, but they're making it very hard for them. And they should, you know, I can handle them making it hard for me because I'm in this business, but don't make it hard for the end purchaser of the product. You want to make things easily accessible. You want them to understand what you're doing, and you want them to get enthusiastic, not confused by the entire thing, you know. And I've had far too many customers look at me with this question face when wondering about Secret Wars or Convergence. All right, that's my rant on that shit anyway. Jesus.
Okay, so
you had a witticism, right? Or did you have a question?
I had a witticism at work today. I was looking through the first collection of Powers. I was looking through
the old Image one.
Yeah, it published by Icon now, of course. But yeah, I was looking through the first Who Killed Retro Girl, right? Retro Girl.
Yeah.
And I kind of forgot that there was actually a time when you could be excited by Bendis.
Yeah. Once upon a time, we did enjoy reading Bendis. Yeah. I remember when we used to come to the shop, we'd talk about what Bendis is writing.
Well, you know, Alias? Remember that?
Yes, Alias.
Yeah, Vernon. Okay. Yeah, Vernon got me on Alias. Vernon actually sold me a hardcover collection of Alias.
No shit.
You did. I still have it. Wow. They never released another hardcover.
Back in the day when Michael Gatos and Brian Bendis actually did work that we didn't mind reading and stuff like that.
Yeah. So it was funny because, I mean, there's a show now. I haven't seen any of it, but, oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was like, I should read this again. Yeah, and then I was like, maybe I should, you know, maybe because at Comics Fondle, I'm always reading something old,
right?
Just to the point where I make myself sick.
Right. Well, you know, Bendis's run, the Image run, is the one I recommend. I mean, once you run through the Image run, that's a good finishing point. It really is, and I recommend to anybody, once you finish the Image run, the first wave or whatever the hell they call it, I forget how many issues there were, stop, you know, and enjoy the series, and enjoy the memory of it in your head, because if you continue onward, it's just going to fall to pieces, because it just gets worse. And the sad thing is, it only sells like 10,000 copies through Marvel, and somebody made the crack like, God, if Bendis took this to Image, it would sell 50,000 copies. And well, I just started my head up. I go, that is true, but also really ironic. Not that it's legal under his exclusivity, but...
Right.
Powers is not pushed by Marvel at all. It occupies a one-page space in their Marvel Previews catalog in the back that nobody gives a shit about. They never fucking mention it. Well, it never comes out. That's a big problem of it. It comes out every 3 to 4 months, so it's not a title you can promote anyway. But, again... Finish the Image run, enjoy the end of it, and move on.
Yeah. So that was just interesting to come across that.
That is odd. Well, what's this thing you got listed on here, Morrison versus Moore? What's the
battle?
This is
the intro to the issue reviews that I got this email from Vernon, what, like 5-6 days ago. He's like, you got to read Multiversity Ultra Comics. I have not been reading the Multiversity.
But tell them why I wanted you to read it.
He wanted me to read it. I didn't know why he wanted me to read it. He didn't say.
Yeah, I know.
So I read the comic, and I was like, does Vernon really like this? Maybe I'll just be as nice as possible about it.
I was deliberately oblique.
And, you know, I get this email from him, and he's like, oh, thank goodness I'm not insane.
Yeah, because so many people liked it.
Oh,
and I didn't hate it. I just didn't think it was very good. You know, and go ahead, please.
No, I mean, like, it reminded me of Marvel Boy. Morrison's already done this.
And better.
Getting better. Yeah, Marvel Boy was better. Marvel There's Boy a story was a to it.
Right, right. Marvel Boy was a character that existed in the story. The problem with Ultra is that what's this phrase that's being banded about? I'm not sure what it means. Like meta. What does meta mean? Help me out here, Mr. How does it relate to Ultra?
It relates to Ultra because it's that the medium you're commenting on the medium through your story.
Yes, and that was right. It was people like the metas, but that drove me nuts because
I was just like, there's no point to it though. It doesn't lead to anything. And that's why I'm saying Morrison versus Moore, in that Alan Moore, especially in Promethea, but then you read something else and you'd realize, wow, he really fucked with me there. But Promethea, starting with issue about 14 or 17, just started fucking with you the entire time. And he's like, I'm fucking with you. That's what I'm going to do right now. I want to control your experience of this book. I want to control your experience of this reading. And, you know, in some ways, Moore is actually annoying because he'll then, like, it just be like, yeah, that's what I was doing. You don't know that. You don't know that as a narrative device. Like, that's really simple. And you're just embarrassed. And it doesn't make you appreciate it less or anything or resent him. And that's, like, one of the beauties of him is it's still so good that you don't get upset with him when he points out that you should have realized what he was doing. Ultra Comics doesn't have any of that. Your, you know, reading of the comic and investing it with your interest is what is fueling the comic. That's the concept.
That's it.
He doesn't do anything with it.
No, you don't get interested in the comic simply because there's no development of the main character or the minor characters or there's no plot.
Nothing.
Right, and we're forced to deal with this over, 35, 40 pages? I don't know what the hell, how long it is. But I'm like, you know, Doug Mankey's art is always a joy to behold.
It was a joy of art. And Vernon really does like Doug Mankey a lot, so I was actually reading it going, am I still supposed to just be like, the story sucks, thank God for the Doug Mankey art? Which is basically what I did. So.
Right. We were very sweet about it. Calling that a story was definitely a generous thing on your behalf because I was like, there's nothing here, you know, and I don't need a commentary on meta. I mean, if I want meta content, I could go read 600.
Well, Morrison's done this before.
Right.
Hold on. Morrison's done this well. That one Batman series where I've always been meaning to reread it was the one where he interacts with all the different eras of Batman.
Yes.
It wasn't like the most successful story ever, but it was really cool and it had good art and it was fine. And it's not like this. This is just him in some just state of desperation at this point. And it's very uncomfortable.
I felt bad because it like sucked all the fucking momentum out of this series of one shots. I mean, you had a nice roller coaster ride of the varying quality of the one shots he's been putting out so far. And then this is the last one before the book ending chapter of Multiversity Part 2, which part one was a bit of a mess that Andrew and I didn't get along with either. So I'm really like, God, you know, you're hitting with a thud here. And it's just, it's very problematic because they're asking people, much like Marvel is, to pay $4.99 for a comic book. And that's a problem because it's not worth $4.99, you know.
What I find very interesting about this big Grant Morrison crossover that was, 3 years in the baking, 4 years in the baking?
Yeah.
They're doing it right before they're relaunching the DC Universe. And I feel like they did this to him before.
Yeah. Yeah, because does anybody believe that Final Crisis was, like, something DC really ever considered
about it all or followed the continuity of canon. It all? No, they did late? They did something right away afterwards, and, you know, none of it actually mattered. And that was because, actually, Final Crisis was a really weird event book. It was very small. Like, it was supposed to be the Young Gods, but it wasn't like huge cosmic warfare. It was very small and confined. I just remember that almost a confined feeling, and not just because.
Right, it's a bunch of isolated moments. That's kind of what it was.
It was very cool. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the most successful thing, and it didn't, you know, reshape the world. It probably wasn't even as successful as Crisis on Infinite Earths. But, you know, it was cool. Like, he was doing something cool. He's not doing anything cool with Ultra Comics. This, you know, Howard the Duck, right?
Right.
Didn't he break
it's the same thing. It's like writing for comics readers. And it's not about, like, writing a comic that's even halfway interesting or even experimental.
Okay, I'm going to say something, Vernon, and nobody is going to – well, actually, our listeners might not have a problem with it. Morrison doesn't do anything newer in Ultra Comics than John Byrne did on She-Hulk in the late 80s.
Right, because he did a lot of self-referential stuff. But you know what? She-Hulk was fun, and he cared about She-Hulk. Even though
he did? It's a good count.
You don't give a shit about Ultra at all. Ultra is just a cipher in his own comic, and that's a problem.
And he looks like Marvel Man, and I just couldn't stop going,
oh, God, you're right, yeah.
Is this just Morrison doing his Alan Moore bashing thing? Like, I wasn't...
We want to reread it with that in mind.
But he doesn't do anything cool with it. I mean, it would have been amazing if Multiversity Ultra Comics with this Grant Morrison, with this Miracle Man stand-in, if at some point Grant Morrison had talked about how the original writer did something.
Right, exactly.
That would be really funny. Like, it would speak to the audience and it would be funny, you know, but they don't do that.
Yeah, but a half-assed disguise attack on Alan Moore is just not going to cut it. To sum it up, Morrison really wasn't working for DC. I don't think he was. He didn't have a presence at DC. I don't know if he was doing any public relations stuff for them at this point. So Multiversity seems to be a post-Morrison publishing effort. And I'm not sure how much involvement he has with the final product. It seems really clunky and dead. I don't know. And I'm not trying to defend him, but it's not how you want your name to finish at a company or whatever. You know, it's not like Morrison may not work for DC ever again, but it's a sad clunk, and it doesn't give me hope for Multiversity issue 2 or whatever the bookend chapter is coming up, which has been delayed to the end of April of all things, so we'll figure that out.
There you go. Do it
right. Well, hey.
Convergence, or no, Convergence has already started, so there you go.
Yeah, I read Convergence Zero today, and it was written by the inimitable Dan Jurgens and drawn by the incredible Ethan Van Sciver, who couldn't draw a graceful figure to save his life. And let's just say that if you read Dan Jurgens' Superman, you're going to like it. If you don't, well, then you probably won't. So you know what camp I'm in on that one.
This is a very interesting statement that Vernon just made. Dan Jurgens, of course, started doing Superman 30 years ago.
Yes, yes. And he masterminded, or didn't mastermind it, but he carried through the death of Superman.
Yes, he did. So, basically, this is as good, this is, DC has come nowhere in 30 years, because I would argue that Dan Jurgens had graceful figures in his art. Back
no,
then.
Ethan Van Sciver.
I'm saying that DC has not actually made any progress. They've erased all of the progress they've made in the last 30 years.
Yes, by going nowhere fast. Yes. It's you know what? There's always lifespans of creators, and I admire Dan Jurgens as his cohorts for doing like Comic Factory put-togethers for whoever wants to hire him. God bless us all as creators. But you know what? I really don't want to read him at DC, and I really don't want to read Superman by him anymore. And it was a pretty dull state of affairs, and Convergence was very ponderous. I think for its 35 or 36 pages, you got like basically this conversation between Superman and Brainiac that's really dull. And I don't know.
One thing that this is just going to be a really quick observation, because we don't usually talk about Superman, frankly.
Or comics, yeah.
Yeah, but I find it interesting that you're talking about the new 52 Superman, who is sort of like Ultimate Superman in that he's a prick. And one of the things I find interesting is that DC and the new 52 see the way of doing a 21st century Superman is by taking away his marriage and sort of making him a player. A little bit. You know, like he broke up Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor, like, oh, or whatever. Whereas in the movie, the first thing they established was Superman, like, having, like, you know, a great respect for Lois Lane.
Oh, yes.
Vernon's making, like, you know,
his power so he could make love to her.
Okay. But anyway, so I just think it's interesting that DC's version of 21st century Superman is very different from the corporate proposal of the subject.
Yes.
But that's about it for that. So
yeah.
Instead, yeah, we weren't going to talk about Convergence 1. It's not on our show list.
Well, this was Convergence 0, just so you know. I threw it in there just as an example of really bad comics.
Okay.
Let's get on to review.
We're done. So now we're going on to Sons of Anarchy. The latest Sons of Anarchy has a new writer, Ryan Ferrer, I hope. So this is issue 19. It's got the Mateus Bergera continuing.
Yeah, one of the guys that works on the title, I think, on a regular. Yeah.
And, you know, we've been talking about Sons of Anarchy, and the reason I wanted this on the podcast is because we've been talking about it since the first issue, probably since the podcast started, you know. And this is maybe the first issue of it after two other writers where I'm just like, I don't really know that I think this guy's got anything to do with this. And it's not like Ed Brisson wrote the whole series. You know, Christopher Golden wrote the first arc that impressed you. So it's kind of like I assumed it would be a sturdy book no matter what they did with it.
Well, once Ed Brisson left the book, it was obvious they were going for, well, this Ryan Ferrer is going through a multi-chapter story at this point, and the setup isn't particularly pleasant, and the character isn't particularly pleasant, maybe to the point of numbness, I guess, when you're reading it. You're right. It's not like, I don't know, it just doesn't have that kick. You know what I mean? Like, when we read Sons of Anarchy, there was a hook in every issue that just grabbed you with it. And here, you don't have that. At least not enough for a multi-part story.
Yeah. So, okay, your turn. Do you have your list?
That was a toughie. But anyway, yeah. You know, I was impressed by, what was it, the first issue that came out this week of We Can Never Go Home Again. Black Mass Comics, I guess a newcomer to the scene. They seem to be well-founded because their production value is really nice. Maybe too nice for some of the book's creators. We talked about last week Curb Stomp number 1 in our last podcast. Uh-huh. We thought was overly produced for the level of creators. But We Can Go Home Again kind of works with that. It's a pretty good story about two teenagers who are runaways. I mean, I don't know if there's a whole lot of new ideas here, but it's executed really nice. And the younger one, or the oddball, becomes involved with a girl because they happen upon one another at an incident, and they both discover a similar thing that they have in common, and that they can't be part of your typical teenage scene. Now, who is it? Hood? God, all these creators are new, so I'm trying to keep up with them as best I can at times. Hood is the writer. I got to figure out this guy's name. Are you familiar with you don't know these books, do you?
You keep telling me to read them, and I'm being very
bad you're busy,
about it.
I know. Josh Hood. Josh Hood, and then the, who is our artist on this book? Kindlin?
Patrick Kindlin.
Yeah. It's, you know, the credits are on the back cover in a horrible, mangled way that I can't read. I'm sorry. But you know what? They do a really credible, kind of punky comic, and this guy Kindlin knows his figures and dynamics, and he knows how to draw graceful humans, and the production values are perfect. And it's a story about two teenage runaways with superpowers, and the first issue did everything that a first issue should. It introduced you to two characters you're interested in. The situation they existed in was accurately depicted and totally convincing, and they leave a hook at the end that makes you want to read the second issue. And this is an odd little book. I don't know how many comic shops are going to carry it, but I kind of recommended it. I really enjoyed it. It was a good debut. Now, Black Mass Comics comes with caveats. I think about half the stuff I've seen for them I'm not real impressed with. But I think that you could probably read We Can Never Go Home number 1 and enjoy it if you like that punk sensibility with really high production values.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. I will read it someday.
Damn well better, man.
Well, hold on now. Sometimes Vernon recommends things to me like that, but he sometimes also tells me to check out things like The Fly Outbreak.
I just said it came out. I didn't say you should.
No, you said you should check it out. It's got really gory art.
Well, you know, and that was my local guy, Chicago guy Menton. I'm trying to think what he did earlier. Last year he did this cult comic that was just absolutely weird in its weird sexual sadistic fetishism and highly detailed. But The Fly didn't have any of those properties when I got it in the shop.
So, yeah, my joke in my post about The Fly was, hey, IDW, now Comics called from 1990, they want their licensed title back. It's this terrible sequel to The Fly 2, and, you know, I have nothing to say about it that I didn't say in my post, except that if you've ever wanted to see Daphne Zuniga from The Sure Thing, The Fly 2, and Melrose Place, reimagined as a dominatrix dominating Eric Stoltz, you need to check out The Fly 2.
Yeah.
Because they apparently were able to keep the likeness rights to these actors from 30 years ago.
Wow. Yeah, I'm flipping through this, and this is some pretty bad artwork. I'm not sure Menton actually received money for this. If he did, well, then good for him. But it's really bad looking. And I don't know. I was kind of impressed when the solicitation came out. I go, ooh, Menton, he did some pretty good stuff. But this ain't it, baby. I guess IDW is cutting him a check for $50 a page or something. I'm not sure. But it's pretty lowbrow stuff. So stay away on that one.
Okay, so next Vernon's going to talk about Surface, which I have failed to read as well.
You bad boy. Well, you know, it's Surface is a nice, like, trippy book. It's in the Morrison Moore type canon where you got three internet computer hackers who are looking for an entrance way to the Surface, which seems to be like a gateway to all reality. It's a concept by Alex Scott, I think the writer, who does Zero, the kind of interesting meta superhero agent story from Image. And he's kind of involved with a little bit of personal philosophy in this book, as well as a nice adventure story. And he really worked on this a little bit. There's a lot of wonderful times here with the interaction between the characters and their journey. It's I'm trying to find the artist, Foss. Let me see if I can get this guy's first name. But you know, when they do these art publications, just put their names on the freaking book so that when I sit here and try to figure this out, that it's handy, you know. Anyway, it's a wonderful person named Foss and Jody Belair, who does the colors, and it's a really nice put together book, and it's punctuated, I think, twice by Alex Cott's philosophical rantings, which he probably should have saved for the back matters of the book. I mean, it interrupts the story, you know what I mean? And it's all right. I think I could read it at the back end, but I don't like having it inserted into the page. You know, that's one thing about, we talked about how these Image books don't have advertising, so it's enabled them to put, like, back matter wherever the hell they want in the comics. And an editor would say, you know what, just throw the stuff in the back. It really doesn't need to interrupt the story. But this is a really wonderful first issue effort, probably dense and chock full of comics for $3.50. It's a much better value than Convergence Zero at $4.99, and I highly recommend this if you're into kind of trippy Morrison-y type stuff, you know. But it's well balanced by the really great mathematical geometric art of Foss and the colors of Belair. A nice book, definitely worth your time. So why don't we take it to something that I read today while I was dicking around? But
you read Curbstomp today?
I did. I read Curbstomp too. But
Curbstomp too. Now, the first issue I was impressed with. Vernon was not as impressed with. The second issue, I'm just sort of like, oh, I don't even know if I'm coming back for three.
You know, it's a toughie. I agree with you on that one.
It's it loses all the, I don't know,
momentum.
Well, not just momentum, but it loses that sort of, knockoff Love and Rockets vibe that they had in the first issue. The first issue felt like it could have been, and this is not knocking the artist, something that they put together and put out themselves, not something that Boom did. And so, you know, the second issue keeps that art style, but loses the writing of it in that way. So, yeah.
The color is,
I don't know.
The colorist saves this one. Jeremy Lawson. Again, we're pulling these names out of our ass, but at least they put the credits on the inside cover. He saves the artwork. The artist, Devaki Nyoji.
Yeah.
Is almost there. He likes to draw foreground figures, but, you know, like, he kind of carries it through with this indie sensibility that gets you through it because he doesn't have the chops to draw backgrounds at all. So he kind of fudges it all the way through. And the colorist saves his butt on this. And the book has a little indie punk sensibility to it. It's a little raw, but you get through it, and it's not too bad. But, you know, I agree with you. The story by Ryan Ferrer, who also incidentally wrote Sons of Anarchy.
Yes.
Yes. That was that surprise I wanted to pull on you there. He seems to be a writer in training, as it were, because there's some certain fundamental bases you have to hit while you're running around the base path as a writer, just like you do as an artist. And he kind of doesn't have a good editor to help him through this. And I agree with you on the – it could have been published by themselves more so necessarily than Boom. It's almost like the Boom package is almost too nice for this
exactly.
level.
If this had, were a little seedier, the punk thing would carry you a lot further. And I frankly think that would help it just because you would be less hard on it.
Yeah. I mean, a full
You would
production.
Have less expectations of it as a finished product, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, the high production values make it look like a professional product, but when you're reading it, it's not like full blown. So you have this like deflation at the end, whereas if it was just printed on shittier paper with 64 color press color, it probably would have made more an impression on me. Let's put it that way. Yeah. The production is hurt. This is a rare case of production values actually hurting the aesthetic.
It is. I mean, can you imagine if like it were like color copied at Kinko's, you know?
Yeah.
It'd
yeah.
be awesome.
Yeah. Well, I was even thinking of how they used to do manga when I was a kid, because manga didn't have color. It was like these huge, thick telephone books printed on shitty pulp paper that was dyed pink and blue and green and chunks.
Oh, yeah, that would have been great.
It'd be printed black or green on top of that. And I go, this would work better with this than it does in full process color, you know? But
what
Kurt
are you going to do?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a new book out from the Mike Mignola Hellboy / Evil Monster Factory, although it just basically touches upon it, called Frankenstein, that came out last week. He gets credit for the writing, Mike Mignola, so he's taking time off from Hellboy and doing this thing. And but, you know, luckily we get Ben Steinbeck on the artwork, who did Witchfinder. Do you remember that from way back?
I do.
First stories? Yeah, Ben Steinbeck is excellent. And I have to say that, you know, like, Frankenstein's been fucking done to death by comic books. I mean, they always talk about, oh, this and that. And I go, yeah, but Frankenstein still sucks in most comic books. I mean, Bernie Wright says Frankenstein, that works. And that's not necessarily a comic book. And there's been a couple other incidences. But it looks like the creators this time have put their personal chops into it.
Okay.
So it doesn't turn into like another shitty Frankenstein knockoff. And Ben Steinbeck's art is just perfect for this shit. I mean, he radiates not just the Hellboy weird aesthetic, but like the Universal Pictures black and white eerie movie scenario.
Oh, nice. I got to check this out. You told me
you gotta
two
read
weeks
the,
ago.
Right. I think you should read the first issue, because Frankenstein is a very fully realized figure here. You know, do you remember that like shitty movie that came out called Frankenstein last year or the year before? I forget what it was, but it was based on a bad comic book from a comic book company that just put shit out just to get it developed. It was called Frankenstein something, and he battled.
Oh, Frankenstein! Oh, crap. The one where he fights the flying monsters?
Yeah. All that shit. I think they were like gargoyles.
Frankenstein. Yeah.
Well, this comic is like that, but better.
Okay.
Like, like you really get into the character, and the tragicness of his come through so much better. And it takes place now, okay? And he remembers things that happened in his life, because Frankenstein does have a huge history.
Right.
And it's really a nice thing if you're a Frankenstein fan. And there's a little bit of the Hellboy aesthetic thrown in there, because not necessarily there's Hellboy characters, although Hellboy does meet him once in the comic.
Interesting.
Right. The antagonists are kind of Hellboy-esque in their, like, backgrounds and what they're doing involved with his legend and stuff like that. But it doesn't hurt the book, though. I'm going to say it doesn't hurt the book. The only thing that hurts the book is the god-awful Mike Mignola cover. The man couldn't draw a cover to save his ass. It has his central perspective. And you got your computer. Whip this thing up on there. I want to show you this thing while I'm talking to you.
Frankenstein
what is Underground.
Underground.
From Dark
Horse. Whoa. There's a novel called Frankenstein Unbound by Brian Aldiss in a movie. People should check that out. Anyway, yes, it looks like a Hellboy cover. I can see it.
It does. It's really bad. What? I don't know what it's about Mike Mignola. He draws these, like, slack-shouldered, big-gutted guys. And, you know, like, Ben Stenbeck, like, takes the electrodes a little more seriously, whereas they're almost like huge fetishistic objects on Frankenstein here. He doesn't really look like a monster. He doesn't look like anything scary. He's just kind of boring.
And he has a nipple.
He has big nipples. Those are not nipples. Those are
nipples.
Those are electrodes.
Sure they are.
Yes, they are. Exactly. Anyway, don't let the cover scare you off. Mike Mignola and Ben Stenbeck do a good job on the comic, but skip the cover anyway.
Okay.
To our favorites.
To Princess Ugg number 8. Now, how did you read this?
Well, like how in manner, the manner I read it, or the
well, I mean, I'm gonna come out and say it is that I got very, you know, teary eyed and touched at the end there.
I was crying last issue. I didn't cry this issue. You know, I cried the green. She got me with green sleeves, singing green sleeves.
Oh God! And I mean, they turn around. Ted Nyaff turns around the bitchy sidekick girl. It's just. And it makes you feel kind of stupid. It made me feel kind of stupid because I'm assuming as I was reading all of these issues that, you know, he didn't have an end game in plan or an end game in mind. And he did. And it just was a lovely last issue.
He always has an end game. Even what was the last thing we were reading by him? Courtney Crumrin's last
one. Yeah.
That threw me for a loop. You know, Ted Nyaff is easily one of the greatest all-ages comic book creators today. And the fact that he uses female-centric protagonists is to his credit. And I don't know if it's a sharply calculated marketing move, but he is undoubtedly one of the best all-ages creators of our generation.
Yep.
And Princess Ugg, he keeps – and little boys can read Courtney Crumrin or Princess Ugg. And what's the one that he doesn't have the rights to? Polly the Pirates from, what was that, fucking Tokyo Pop. These are great books. Princess Ugg is the latest in a series of real strong female protagonists. And Ted Nyaff creating these, like, wonderful stories for them to exist in. And I have to say, this is the first time I was in tears. Like, I mean, when they went to see the Queen last issue and she was singing Green Sleeves – And the queen said to the bitchy cohort, well, I don't get it. And she goes, well, dear, you're too young to have never known loss. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, I can't take
it. It was so good. And it's just frustratingly good. And, yeah.
You know, and like, it's so funny because, and even my customer, Jean Leah, you know who she is,
yes.
Pointed this out, that both of us, well, maybe me so more than you, but to some degree, we both had somewhat minor problems during Princess Ugg. And in conclusion, I'd say it's not so much the problems with Princess Ugg, but the fact that it seems like Ted Nyaff is so filled with ideas and he has to get them out in 8 issues, where I think I could have gone with this tale twice as long as what it was done now.
Right.
Because I just know he could have carried this for 12 to
15
years. Well,
he said Princess Ugg would return. Didn't he?
Right. In the end.
Or he's like, it's over for now or something like
well,
that.
No, he said it will return, right.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, it's going to come back and that's good. Yeah, it was just a good issue. And
Hey, we should all of our podcast people probably already know this, but Princess Ugg is a great little mythological story about a barbarian princess, basically, who comes into civilization trying to enter a school for diplomatic studies. Princesses, right, a school for princesses, how to be a princess. And it starts there, but it just grows on so many tangents involving her fellow princesses, the conspiracy about what the king who's in the who owns the school they work in, what his deals are. There's the bitchy friend who's her roommate that has all sorts of dimensions to her that we really don't get. I mean, I don't want to get into detail, but even this character is handled great, you know?
Yeah.
And we never did get back to the fucking teacher who she met in the beginning.
No.
Who convinced her to stay in school.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So, I know.
So these little things make me think that Ted Knife has got like this grand thing in him. He could just fill this out wonderfully. I feel horribly shortchanged by just 8 mere issues having to wait for more, you know? Especially when they make you reach for the Kleenex. That's the problem.
Okay, so next Vernon's going to talk about 8, which I haven't read yet.
You know, I'm doing too much talking. I swear to God, I'm going to take the whip to you on this next broadcast. 8. Okay, you and I were talking. Let's combine these two, 8 and Dave, okay? I'm on both of these. Dave 2, these are both science fiction books. And or what was it that you know? And I didn't get to read what's the one with your guy Dennis Cusero in it?
Cluster.
Cluster that came out 3.
Yeah,
and I haven't had a chance to read that one. So there's like so much science fiction going on at the Image Universe right now. I haven't read the Cluster. I read the Dave 2. Dave 2 follows right along on the same pattern as Dave 1. And ups the ante considerably for the protagonist and his family, involving a robot and his convergence into middle-class deadism, as it were, when his whole reason for being becomes suspect. Great stuff. Great, good humor. Now, 8 is a little more successful as a piece of science fiction, I think, more so because Mike Johnson and Raphael Albuquerque seem to be hitting together as creators. The chemistry is really good. But this guy that travels through dimensions to get to this one specific place, and he finds a civilization there. And it's really great because it takes the whole, like, Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert E. Howard traditions of, like, characters going in other places beyond their Earth and starting from scratch and becoming an interesting character. And Albuquerque's art on 8 is just wonderful. And this is a book I can highly recommend. It's only 5-issue miniseries. I think Dave is 5 or 6, and they're both great intermittent little reads from Dark Horse and Oni? I don't know. It's a long day. I think Dave is IDW, and 8 is from Dark Horse, and both of them are really recommended because I don't know. They present what's that phrase? I was at the Art Institute, and they had this phrase on the second floor: all art is about art. And when you look at it, there's no new ideas. There's just how contemporary interpretations of them work for society. And 8 and Dave are both successful interpretations of science fiction comic books on a humorous and a highly dramatic one. And both of them are, incidentally, both perfect for media development, which is obviously the main reason for the writers. But, hey, you know something? They're good books, and I highly recommend them. I'm going to turn it over to you for a while now because you get to have Garth Ennis' finished chapter on war stories. And I'm going to comment, I think, a little
on it. So, Garth Ennis finishes up war stories, number 6.
Second arc.
It's the Israel, 1972 Israel arc. And quite unexpectedly, he turns it into a soapbox.
Somewhat.
And there's a young Jewish soldier who voices all these prophetic opinions about how even in 50 years there will still be these problems and how we need 2 states and I don't actually know that they go that far, but it just goes on, and it's all this talking, and I'm just kind of like, Garth, you had an issue here. You could have done a good issue.
right.
this.
Right. And having the foresight of the, was it 67 or 72 war, like, okay, you can say these things now. You can have a prophetic character now. But in the heat of the battle there, I don't know if that's really going to be the story. It seems to be like a post-war story told in the current time of when it was fought. It's kind of odd.
Yeah. It was unfortunate. And of course, it's not like the art got any better. I mean, the art was...
Well, it was Avatar's best.
I don't believe that. I do not believe that that was Avatar's best. I think they cheaped out on Garth.
You know, I hate to say it as a retailer. If you want to look at it from another perspective, war stories sells like...
Yeah.
War stories. And that's what the budget dictates who you
exactly.
get on the
Exactly. That's what they do to keep Garth happy.
You know what? And I hate to say it. I'll probably continue to read Garth.
I will,
war stories, no matter how bad they get, because I love my Garth and I love his war stories. And God help me that he
is where he will have his most surprising and, you know, cool moments.
Challenging as well.
Yes. So I'm going to continue on into talking about Abigail and the Snowman, which, similarly to Princess Ugg, but actually not quite as effectively, has Roger Langridge closing up his series with an unexpected turn of events. And in this case, it's not a... Princess Ugg, you know, had a big turn of events, big surprises with characters. Not so much in Abigail and the Snowman. It's just how the story progresses. And it just... When I started this series, I was kind of thinking to myself that this is just Roger Langridge doing his new thing. Whereas after finishing the series, it is still Roger Langridge doing something new and trying things, and it's really cool. And it was a far better book than I was hoping for.
Landridge is I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but Landridge is just a great creator, and you're always like on the lookout for him. So how did this book add up at the end? I mean,
you know, even when he's gonna do the expected thing, he's still going to be able to do something unexpected. And one of the things about Landridge, and one of the things that makes him so, not just a special creator, but also a really good creator for kids, is that he will have unexpected depths to certain characters that the reader isn't expecting, but upon these events happening, the reader, you know, replays them in his or her head to see how it sort of works. And it's not unraveling a narrative trick. It's just processing that revelation requires these particular thoughts or memories of events in the story. And it's like, it's really good for kids. I mean, it Langridge manages to do a book that has a lot of good stuff for every possible audience member.
Landridge is an interesting creator. He has really high capabilities with his tools as a cartoonist, and he constantly pushes, well, he has pushed formal boundaries quite successfully. And, you know, I admire his tenacity in using the female protagonist. I mean, I've got female protagonists all over the store now. It's amazing. I mean, it's like the new hit movement. We have young girl characters. I mean, your mom coming out, your daughter, I need a comic book. I got like 12 of them that have nothing to do with Marvel and DC, or some of them do, but they're all girls, you know. And I feel bad for Roger. His work is such high quality, but he seems, I don't know whether he picks the least commercial route to go.
Yeah.
It's... you know, it's tough. You love this guy, and he's one of the best cartoonists of our generation. But, you know, you're like, you want to see him succeed. And you're like, wow. You pick, like, this little niche of a niche of a niche, and you go for it. And I'm not quite sure that that's going to put you on the map, but it's still a good product, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I would, you know, and like what is it, Abigail and the Snowman? Was that like four issues and done?
Four issues, double-sized final issue.
Okay, so that'll make a nice little trade paperback. Yep. I hope that succeeds. Who's the publisher on this now?
It's Kaboom, the Boom imprint for kids.
You know what? I'll be on the lookout for this, and when it comes in, I'll make sure it's racked because you know what? You and your kids could do certainly a lot worse than reading Roger Landridge. That's for damn sure. When I look at some of the stuff that's coming out on the racks for younger people.
One of the things I love at work is, you know, a lot of kids' books are not like picture books, but grade school books are graphic novels. Raina Tekemeninger, or whatever her name is, the Smile.
Yep, something like that.
Yeah, so I'll have these kids come in, and they tend to be girls, and they're like, "Do you have anything like this?" And they won't call it a comic, they won't call it a graphic novel. They'll say like it's got the pictures with, and one of my great joys is giving these girls Snarked.
Excellent.
Yes, and Abigail and the Snowman will be another one like that. And it's just, you know, Langridge does a good job. And, you know, someday when they're teenagers, they'll be able to read The Mighty Thor, and it will hopefully get them into resenting and hating Marvel.
Yeah, or what was it? No, the Paul book, Paul Pope sequel to Batlin Boy with the girl protagonist.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, no, I was just continuing on the line of Roger Langridge.
Yes, okay, right, yes. Right. Landridge is great. Right. He's perfect.
Okay.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
So now Vernon's going to talk about...
Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to talk about Chrononauts. I'm going to say it in one sentence or less, okay? It's Mark Millar. It's decently executed Mark Millar. It's set for media development. It reads like a movie comic. I kid you not. And he is very fortunate to be paired up with Sean Murphy, and who is also equally lucky to be paired up with Mark Millar. And so if you're a fan of this kind of product, go for it. If not, take the pass.
And so as that wraps up our comic book reviews, last weekend, a friend of ours, Jim Caldwell, passed away. And I met Jim at Vernon's Comic Book Shop. So we thought it would be a sort of nice thing to talk about him a little bit here on the podcast, especially since a lot of Vernon's customers listen to the podcast. And a lot of you probably got to meet Jim at least a couple times, and we know that a bunch of you got to know him better. So I got back into comics when I moved back to the Chicago area, when I moved to Evanston in 2003-2004, and I ended up at Vernon's shop. And I ended up at Vernon's shop undoubtedly at some point, probably to get a fucking Kevin Smith comic on a Wednesday. And I know that that's possible because I went to that Webb's comic place in Skokie, and those guys didn't stock. They didn't have a copy of Clerks or some shit like that. And I was just like, fuck this place. And the guy's like, no, I'll have it for you tomorrow. And he's like on the phone to other shops. And you carried all the Oni shit. And
I'll
so,
never
anyway.
Call other shops doing that shit, man. Fuck
so. I end up going to Vernon's, and of course I'm going on Wednesday. And Jim was there, and Jim hung out on Wednesdays back then. This is about 10 years
easy. Yeah. Before you moved, man.
Before, well, like not just before I moved, but like 3 years before I moved. Jim and a guy named Danny, I think. And every Wednesday, you know, we just hang out at Vernon's for, I don't know, hour and a half. I mean, we'd start getting, Vernon would never kick us out, but we'd start getting self-conscious.
Like.
Start getting self-conscious when we'd gone through 5 or 10 regular customers, and we're just like, we gotta get out of here.
Hey, if these guys want to stand, I'm good with that.
Vernon doesn't have any files left. Everybody, all his subscribers pick up their files in the amount of time we've been standing around here. And Jim was always incredibly, I wouldn't even say he was diplomatic or understanding of people's differing comic opinions. He was just, you know, he embraced them without agreeing with them. He was enthusiastic. He was a great fixture for your shop because he could be genial with your, you know,
anybody.
Well, your guy picking up, let's say, I don't know, the latest
Vertigo book.
No, your Vertigo customers, I'm thinking more your, I don't know, your, let's just say your Cable Deadpool crossover.
Oh, okay, the Marvel heads.
The Marvel thing, and Jim was not a Marvel guy. Jim was a DC guy. I don't know if Jim ever read a Marvel comic that I know of.
Really? Yeah, he was strictly DC as far as I know. No, we lie.
We lie?
Oh, he was a lover of the Hernandez brothers.
He was. I mean, and this was when I discovered Love and Rockets was
right.
Vernon and Jim, and it was awesome. Yes, so yes, indie, yes, but Marvel.
No,
we got him to read. We got him to read Ed Brubaker's Daredevil, the first arc. We did get him to read that because there was some like. And nobody's going to understand this anymore since it's been out for 9 years and tons of trades. But the issue of Daredevil that ended with Frank Castle in the cafe shooting a criminal to get thrown in to save Matt Murdock.
Yep.
That was an exciting Wednesday the week after that came out when everybody was just like, dude, did you read that? And Jim was on board for that. Jim was actually on board because of Michael Lark. He liked
Michael Lark.
Yes, he was.
That was the thing. Like at the shop, you know, no matter what comic you read or what company you liked, there were plenty of creators who we all found common ground with.
Yes,
you know what I mean. Michael Lark, obviously, like everybody likes Michael Lark. Yeah.
Scene of the Crime, I remember, was one that Jim and I talked about. Yeah, and so. You might also know, Jim, if you've been to C2E2 or Wizard in the old days, right? They did it at Wizard.
He's part of the
group that challenges Mark Waid in Silver Age
trivia.
And it is a weird, weird thing because I don't think it was C2E2. I think it must have been – was it a Chicago –
they started at Wizard World.
Wait, they started at Wizard World, but I remember one time that I think it must have been a Wizard World where we didn't go see it. I didn't see it, certainly. I don't know if you went to go see it.
Well, my Wizard World shows were punctuated at the end there before C2E2 came.
I remember Jim talking about all the preparation he and his team put into this, like the challenging of Mark Waid.
Jim would study. Every time I go on show. So it's like I'm still reading like Silver Age, trying to catch up on my Silver Age stuff, and I'm going through these black and white phone books. What do they call them? DC Showcase?
Yeah!
And I'm like, holy Christ. He goes, you know, we got to face off against Mark Waid. And I'm like, and we slowly got used to the idea that Jim was part of a team of local Chicago area individuals that would take on Mark Waid annually at our convention in the Silver Age trivia contest.
Right.
And it became quite a place to be for us old geeks who are well into their 20s and some of us into our 30s and beyond. And it was the place to be, and Jim was always part of that. And Mark, how would you describe it? At one point, people like you and me are blown away because we just didn't read Silver Age comics.
Well, yeah, you're blown. Well, because you're kind of, I'm thinking, well, what's the episode, what's the issue that Superman moves?
I'll just cut off my head now.
Or something. But that's not what the question was. The question's like, what magnet did Linda Danvers have on her refrigerator in Supergirl 157 on the third miscolored panel?
Right. Yep.
And the thing is, when we went to go see it at C2E2, we went to go see the first one. And I think there were a bunch of us there at the first C2E2.
Right. We told everybody to get there for the Trover.
Yeah, and because that first C2E2, there was a comics gallery limited edition T-shirt. And
oh,
so,
if you're lucky, you can see a picture somewhere on the internet.
Yeah, somewhere on the internet. But we all went to Jim's panel and did that. And it was over in like 7 minutes. Mark Waid beat them in like 7 minutes. I don't think Jim got to talk.
But every year it was kind of like the Harlem Globetrotters versus the Washington Generals. You know, like inevitably you knew Mark Waid was going to like pull the basketball away and win, but he would always face off against like four or five local Chicago guys, Jimbo included, that would like keep up for a while, but then ultimately like the ultimate like memory of Mark Waid would just win all the time. But it was a great thing to go witness because these guys, you know, there was not a guy on that stage that was under 30 years old. I mean,
well, no, Silver Age. I mean, Jim was a DC guy, and it was really funny. I remember this one time I was telling. I think I was telling you guys that I was reading The Outsiders, and it sort of, you know, just was a comment I made that I was reading The Outsiders because DC had put out that the black and white,
the big hunk.
Yeah. And then like about 2 minutes later, Jim just looks at me and he goes, "You're a Mike W. Barr fan, aren't you?" And I was like, I like some Maze Agency. And he's just like, uh-huh. And it was just this perfect amount of knowledge. And
yeah, I would have to say that I agree. Like, Jim could, like, traverse all dimensions of comics. Like,
because if he didn't know firsthand about something, he knew somebody who knew about it.
Right.
I remember that. I mean, we talked about what? I mean, we would have been talking about Swamp Thing. We would have been talking about Love and Rockets. There would have been just so much. And Jim knew all of it.
Well, you know, Jim was part of like our Three Little Stooges. Andrew,
we were
Jim
Three and Little Stooges. Yeah. We, what was it? There was the, we went to the pizza place by your shop.
Yeah, found the corner there, yeah.
Yeah, and I believe there was another place we tried another time. But, yeah, so we would
congregate in the back of my store after hours.
Yep, Thursday nights, and we would try to figure this out. And Jim would come about once every month, maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, maybe once every 3 weeks, maybe. Maybe even more than that, but he wasn't there every week, so we got to look forward to Jim coming in and hanging out, and it was really funny because Jim knew mainstream comics from when Vernon didn't. So for me, you know, I got both angles of it. I got Jim, who knows mainstream from 80 to 85, Vernon, who's just kind of like, what are you talking about? There was something called Secret Wars, man. I was reading Linda Barry, you know?
Yeah, so, you guys were closer in age, I swear. And here was the thing. When you guys talk about TV and movies, I would just sit there with my eyes glassy because you guys know all that shit. And I'm like, man, I don't know anything, and these guys are just totally involved.
Oh, so there was... Okay, I can actually tell everybody when this actually happened. So,
it's in the back room of the Comics Gallery Thursday evenings, and, you know, we get a couple six-packs, hang out, and talk until our wives would call us up and wonder what the hell was going on.
Which and, they did! Remember that? Yes. They did that all the time!
I'm not shitting you, man. Yeah. but you know, we were very innocent. We just sit there at the table and the chairs in the back end of my shop and just hang out and chat about comic book, pop culture. Well, and it was a sublime experience.
It was. Jim, and it, one of the love, like, so at this point I had started the Stop Button blog, which had, at that time it had movie and comic book stuff, and like people at the shop knew about it, so Jim knew about it. And there was this one day that I don't know if we'd even started really hanging out with him yet, but April 26, 2006, so what is that, that's 9 years ago almost, I did a week series, a week long series on the American International Pictures Doug McClure movies with wow. Kevin Connor directing. And I just remember I was waiting for it. I knew Jim would have something to say about it.
Yeah.
I just knew he would. And I like watched them the week before, and I was like scheduling when they were going to post. And I came into the shop on April 26th. I mean, whatever day it was. It probably wasn't the first day, but it was the second or third. And I came in, and I was the first one there. And Jim came in a few minutes later, and he just comes up to me, and he's like, "What are you doing with your life?" And what he was saying was, "Why the hell are you watching At the Earth's Core?"
Because it's Edgar Rice Burroughs.
And I was just like, it was just this perfect moment. And it was just great. And it was just this wonderful vibe to the shop. And
yeah,
Vernon, of course, never gave us kickbacks for doing his sales pitches on the floor for him.
The shop was an organic tool of its own.
It was. It was... And then so we went to, he was at C2E2. We had remember when we went to Milwaukee to see that?
The art exhibit. It was 100 years of American comic book art or something like that.
And so there was some Winsor McKay there, I remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there was some Kirby. And so what we did was, is we went up and we.
Road trip, you're right.
We road tripped up to, well, it's not much of a road trip. I mean, like, it got exciting, like, ooh, it's that big mall across the street from Six Flags. But anyway, so we get.
There was so much energy in that car on the way up to Milwaukee. I can't say it in words.
Yeah, I mean, we were thrilled because it was going to be, well, I think I came up with the idea that we should tour the comic shops because I knew about that place that opened in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And so we go up, we had lunch at some brewery. I don't know if we got Jim to drink at the brewery. We might have gotten him to drink just like a sampler at the brewery.
Right, right. We do these, I forget what they call them, floats.
The flights,
flights.
So we went to the brewery, we drove around, we went to the museum, and we're all like, you know, Milwaukee's just cool.
Yeah, remember when we got to that comic shop and you, me, and Jim were at the window of this place, and it was the most interesting one. It was fucking closed.
It was on that corner.
It had layers of racks, and Jim looked at us, man, I can only imagine how old the comic books are that are on that rack.
Oh, and then he would have had a great anecdote about that one guy. Was it Phoenix?
Oh, yeah, the guy at Phoenix Comics in Chicago or Skokie area.
Yeah, wherever that was is like, I don't know how often Jim must have gone there. What, maybe every 4 months, but like we'd get feedback on how big the stacks had gotten. He'd like have, you know, something like, yeah, there was a, you know, like 1989 Batman the movie figure on there or something. He's like, I think they just found it.
Yeah, it came out when the stack fell over and my ass hit it.
But yeah, so then we kept touring Milwaukee, and we ended up at this one comic book shop that I had found on a previous trip up there that was only open at night. It was open from 4 to 9.
Yeah.
And I just remember we were... we were talking to the guy, and I just... He was talking about how excited he was by the Jack Kirby art.
Okay.
Which we had all sort of just glazed over.
Right. Yeah. Well, Jack's not the king, but there's a whole lot of...
There was a lot more... There was a lot cooler stuff there, but this guy was only interested in the Avengers art or whatever.
He was a good comic shop clerk.
He was a good guy. And I was just like... At that point, I noticed that Jim had just, like, exited the conversation. He was just like, I'm going to see what else you got around here, then I'm going to go.
That was quite good. Jim and you and me on that road trip, just checking out that artwork, that was just truly...
It was a fun trip.
Yeah, it was one of the best road trips I'd ever been on. Jim was great. He was a regular at the shop for many years, and he had a presence that can't be replaced. When you say about a person that leaves a vacuum, he would definitely be in that definition. And it's difficult because, you know, we enjoyed our time with him and we're very grateful for it.
There was a real thoughtfulness. Jim, I remember right after I moved here to Denver, so it took me, you know, 7 years to get Vernon to agree to the podcast, but
7 years
we regularly talked, you know, and someday I think I actually had to talk him into getting an iPad for the podcast. So he and I have been in regular contact. And I mean, I saw Jim when I went back to Chicago, but I did not, I didn't stay with him. I've stayed with you. I mean, we spent Christmas together a few years ago. Because, you know, we were Jim's comic book shop friends. I mean, better than some, not as good as others. But Jim just had this real... he listened when you were talking to him about something, even if he didn't agree with it. Or even if he had a different opinion. And that's a rarer thing today than it was... You know, Vernon's shop is a Marvel and DC shop, but it trends a little bit more DC back then. Just a little bit more, maybe not in rack space, but more in customer sentiment. That even if you didn't have just like strict Marvel heads, but you might have had strict DC heads. And that's an environment that in some shops can lead to a lot of hostile feelings toward your fellow regular customer. And I mean, that's like stupid, right? Like, it's a stupid thing that's an existing situation, but we just have to look at the internet to know that's, you know, human nature of men and geeky subjects. Like, we suck.
Well, I don't like the new ears on the Batman.
Yeah, you know, there aren't enough sequins on Shazam's cape. Jim never did that. And Jim never did that with me when we disagreed about a movie, like, violently. I remember that
violently with Jim, that's interesting.
Well, I mean, I just remember that he was totally fine with whatever Harry Potter movie I saw, and I posted some scathing response to it. And he sent me an email, and he was just kind of like, I don't know, dude, it didn't bother me that much, you know? It was like... this really cool thing. And so I, you know, Jim and I, Vernon got to see him every 3 weeks or a month, but I got to see him when I went back to Chicago, for C2E2. And sometimes we'd make sure to meet up at Vernon's shop, but you know, it was like, it was on email, and recently it was on Twitter and a little bit on Twitter, and Jim actually said a really nice thing about my movie blog about a week ago, but it was mostly on email, and at the beginning of this year, I was asking Jim for some advice on what I was going to be doing with my blog, the other blog, for the year. And that's not like a serious question in some way, since I don't make enough money off these to make myself happy, much less my wife. But, you know, I knew that I could ask Jim about it, and he would be, you know, he would, his answer...
Totally objective.
Exactly. And I was asking for suggestions for audio commentaries, and I'm actually doing one of the ones he gave me, which was Pump Up the Volume, which I remember we talked about at some point over the years. But he just was like, you could do one on Miller's Crossing. And then in parentheses, he goes, you had a lot of fair points on that. He's like, this was his list of favorite movies. So the top movie on his favorite list that maybe he didn't number it, but it was the first one he thought of, was Miller's Crossing, the Coen Brothers. And I had given it a problem. I mean, like, I had given it a not negative review, but I had given it one talking about its major problems, which is why I couldn't love the movie. And Jim was like, fair points on your review. And you don't get that. I mean, that's not the divisiveness of the internet. And Jim was never a divisive guy. He always was...
calm.
He was... I don't know if I ever saw Jim excited.
Not... Well, he'd get excited, but not...
He'd get like... excited about subject matters, but you'd never see him come in and just be like...
Jesus, on a stick. You know, I mean, he was not like that. He was, but you know, it was just that energy, that exuberance, that love of being around people, you know?
And, this is a little bit off topic, but, you were there for a lot of it, is that, I don't know if this makes it. Jim wasn't just loved by us.
Oh, God, no. When I started getting them Facebook things, I'm like, oh, my God. You're talking about people who went to college with him, what, 20-something years
ago?
Yeah,
and I mean, when we, you know, Jim was very invested in his niece and nephew's lives, and I just remember... That was some of the stuff we talked about. Like, Jim would talk about that. I'd talk about my rat. Like, years later, Jim would be like, I remember when you were freaking out about feeding your rat fish meal. And I'm just like, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, I raised my daughter, and she's a little older than his nephew and niece. And we would compare stories about how the kids grow up together and the similar types of things that, as a caretaker for a younger person, you encounter. And Jim was an incredibly sensitive and astute person with children and younger people as well. Yeah. I mean, he adored his nephew and niece, and he was just that kind of guy. You know, he was very sensitive, you know.
Yeah.
It's difficult. You know, he came in the shop like a week before, less than a week, and I was like, wow. I said to myself, you know, him not coming through the shop doors again. Wow. That is something that really affects me greatly. Well, and I was very amazed to think that, you know, not too many people in my 20 years of doing business hit that level. So, I don't know. It's difficult. And, you know, a lot of you who are listening to this don't know Jim. But... he was a piece of our history.
Jim, I think for years, I was always trying to get Jim to do something. I was always trying to get him to blog. I don't know if I ever really bugged him that much once Vernon and I started doing the podcast to do an episode with us, but I always secretly hoped he would. Like, before C2E2 the last time, I secretly hoped he would want to record a podcast episode in your shop.
Right. Yeah. Because he's a natural. Yeah.
He just would have been perfect at it. And he, I wouldn't say he was shy. Nobody gets up on stage and wants to argue Superman's cup size in 1965 by Kurt Swan is shy. But he always was very... You know, he listened and he thought about it, and when he had something to say, it was of great value. And Jim didn't read all of the comics that Vernon and I did, certainly not all the ones that I did. Back then, I was a retro DC 80s guy, so Jim knew about that. We got to mention that Jim was a big Legion fan, and he acknowledged that it was sometimes his undoing. That I think it was Mark Waid who wrote that Legion series, wasn't it? But Jim,
I couldn't tell you because I've read one fucking Legion series, and that's it, brother.
But so Jim was always telling me I had to read the Great Darkness Saga, and this was in 2006. It was out of print. Amazon was not what it is today. You know, internet comic book piracy was not what it was today. And they were expensive as hell from Mile High Online or whatever. And so it took me years to get to it, but it's a great book. But yeah, I mean, Jim just, he stuck with his Legion when it was good or when it was bad. And that is a very...
Through the 90s, man. Wow.
I don't know how often he read those issues. But, I mean, he was this wonderful synthesis of the critical comic book reader, thinker, historian, which is basically what being a comic book reader is, as well as a fan and a collector. And you know we can't tell the story about a certain somebody's dead son and why that should make us buy a certain number of comics, but fuck it, I'm leaving this in. But if you were in Vernon's shop in a certain year, I would make this one comment, and Jim would punctuate it with some wonderful... thing about that. But he never started it because Jim was, you know.
Jim was honorable, unlike us.
Unlike us. He was not. Yeah. So. I always wanted him to share that because his enthusiasm for so many older comics that you would never have tried to get anybody to read, Jim did.
Jim did, and he loved them. He loved them.
Even with their problems. And that, you know, that's a really cool thing to be able to... And, you know, this went over to TV. Jim and I, over the years, have just had great email conversations about TV and movies. And one of the best reviews I ever got of my movie podcast... Jim emailed me and he said that this is not my current movie podcast. This is the one I did for 5 or 6 years. But, you know, Jim would have been one of the first people I told about it. He said that listening to the Alan Smithy podcast reminded him of being in the back of Vernon's shop.
Wow. Yeah.
And I don't know what the hell this is, 10 days ago, 12 days ago, I've been doing some Twitter thing for my other site, and Jim would comment occasionally, and I'd just sort of started, this was the end of the first month, and I was posting about Tank. And Jim's Tank is a Jim Garner movie from 1984.
Oh, my God. Now I remember.
Yeah. And Jim responded to it. I saw Tank in my hometown Dollar Theater. And then he said, why I read you. Nostalgia for a pleasant time filler. Your take. A plan to revisit.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember that before that C2E2, I had just... I just changed the format of the movie site, the stop button, to get rid of star ratings because whatever. And we were talking about it at your shop. It would have been that April before C2E2 or whatever. And we were probably eating that pizza. And yeah. We were probably bitching about how much it cost. And
yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely.
That was a very elite pizza place over there, Vernon. But Jim was like, I missed the star ratings because I liked reading a review of some movie I really liked and seeing all the nice things you said about it, then getting to the bottom and seeing that you gave it a star and a half. And I don't think I knew Jim when I started writing on the internet comic book and movie reviews, but I didn't know Jim then, actually, because that was like before I even started buying new comics or something.
Right. Yeah, before you started skulking around my shop.
Yeah, pretty much. But Jim was the ideal reader because he was always thoughtful and always considerate and
cared. He always cared.
And if Jim rarely commented on the stop, I could have looked and seen how many times he did. But he would email me after something that I posted that he like really that he had that one of his favorites.
You took issue with.
Not even one that I took issue with, just something I really liked, he would email me. But yeah, one that I took issue with, he would email me about it and tell me why he thought it was good. And so Vernon and I found out that Jim had passed on Thursday.
Yes.
And that morning, I had been thinking about how I wanted to do interviews next year on the movie site, but not with like actors or directors, but with movie fans. And Jim was right there on the list of people that I wanted to talk to about that idea. Because his experience seeing movies, even if I didn't always agree with him, like about Harry Potter, was much like his experience with comics. It was this wonderful, like I said, synthesis of irrational emotional attachment and critical thinking.
And that's what we're all about.
And that's what we're all about. And that's what, like, in some ways, you and I think, have grown as comic book readers over the last 10 years, is that, you know, we might not necessarily have thought about. I know I didn't think as much about art until I had to listen to you talk about it all the time.
God help you.
And I know you, from the shit you recommended to me, I know you didn't care about writing.
I went to the Art Institute of Chicago.
So did I!
God, Jesus.
So...
Jim was like the, what would you call him? The equalizer.
Jim was he was an equalizer because... And it wasn't just with comics or movies or TV. It was...
Presence.
Even if you 100% disagreed with Jim, I read every word of his rebuttal to my Harry Potter 4 post, and I thought about it. Because he put thought into those things, and Jim was a sincere, authentic person.
Yes. You know, there was never a false side to him or an emotional side or anything resembling other than a real side. It was very amazing. Very amazing. I'd have to say that was, you know, you talk about a person's uniqueness, and you'd have to say that about Jim, that he was very consistent about his attitude and interpretation of life. And it was never anything less than that.
And it always was empathetic to others. Do you remember?
First and foremost.
Do you remember he used to have, what was it, a bag? He carried a bag with him. Was that Jim?
For a while,
because he'd take the train to your shop, and we'd...
That was before he bought a car.
Because I didn't actually... I was when he had a car. And we'd see Jim come over from the... the Wilmette, whatever the hell... What is that called?
The Red Line. Yeah.
And we'd be waiting for Jim to talk about something. We'd actually wait.
Right. Where's Jim?
We can't actually start talking about this. Because this was a wonderful period. In some ways of comics, because it was when Dan Slott was starting She-Hulk. Remember that? It was when we could get excited about...
Mainstream comics.
Mainstream comics for a little bit. Wednesday Comics. The New Frontier.
Yep.
That was definitely a period. And it was just... it was a very exciting time for mainstream comics that is dead, but... Jim managed to stay positive about some of it. I know you told me he stuck with the both Legion series through the New 52.
Yep. He collected the writings of Paul Levitz. Until Paul Levitz was dethroned and left as a writer doing freelance work and then doing their Tashin history volumes.
But I remember Jim got me to read the Huntress backups that were collected with art by Joe Stanton.
Wonderful.
And he would he'd be like, what'd you think of that, Stanton? When I come in, he'd just be like...
And he would say it, no, and he says, well, you know, I knew it wouldn't be what you'd want, but I'm just kind of curious as to what you got to say about it.
And Vernon would be like, what are you guys reading? I was reading Linda Barry then.
Yeah, you guys, like, give me a hit off your bong, and maybe I can get on that level.
But I remember there was one issue of that. There was one issue of that Huntress series that somebody good inked Joe Stanton, and I was like ecstatic about it. And Jim was just kind of like, I was waiting to see when you'd get to that like one good issue because he remembered it, and I was like, did you get the trade? And he's like, no, I remember it from, you know.
He had great memories of that stuff. Books, yeah.
And we're at an immeasurable loss for not having Jim around anymore, and everybody else is at an unknown immeasurable loss for never having gotten to meet him.
Absolutely. He was aces, baby. Aces.
So, yeah.
On that one.
Yeah.
We'll conclude another podcast of the Comics Fondle.
Another podcast of the Comics Fondle.
Remembering one of the Chicago greats of Chicago fandom.
And he really was. I mean, I don't know if he spent money at other shops, Vernon, but he knew other shops.
That was part of the history.
And other people knew him, and I don't know if C2E2 has happened yet. I don't think it has. I think that he actually checked in with me about getting ready for the panel this year, or whether or not they were going to do it. So,
well, I
if
can't
you're
going
to be there at C2E2 this year, I would say check out that panel because
it's the one to go to.
It's the one to go to, and I would imagine that that Jim's team of Silver Age guys will have prepared something to say as opposed to what Vernon and I did, which was get drunk and try to talk about this.
Well, one thing's for sure. Without Jim, they're going to lose. And on that one.
On that one. Well, okay, yeah, thanks everybody for listening. I've been drinking Guinness. Vernon's been drinking something from a can.
Well, yeah, Revolutionary Brewery, you hear.
There you go. And
thanks for listening. I mean,
thanks for listening. And yeah,
we love you all. It sounds sentimental and trite, but it's true.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Ciao.